everybody, Matt Bubala with you here, 720 WGN. Kim Bellaware is in studio with us. Hey, Kim, how are you?
I'm doing well, Matt. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely, always. When last we spoke, the Huffington Post had just shut down their Chicago offices.
Yeah.
Leaving you and how many people out of a job?
At
least temporarily.
Well, officially, as far as union members, it was more than 40, but I think the overall number...
It was a big office for you guys.
Well, no. That was of everybody, because it was the AOL-Yahoo merger that precipitated all of this. So not a lot of editorial presence in Chicago, but...
So there were nationwide layoffs.
Yeah, nationwide.
About 40
so
people. Okay.
I would say maybe a fifth of the newsroom.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny you say the AOL-Yahoo merger, and it just sounds like there's been... Anytime AOL gets associated with anything...
Did we go through a time warp?
It does not turn out well, does it? Because AOL... Do you remember when AOL bought Time?
Yeah, Time Warner.
How crazy is that?
The messiest divorce, one of the messier divorces in media history.
And probably the stupidest combination ever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed like a great idea at the time. There's a lot of things we could probably go back in the meet over the last 10 years and say, you know, when the Tribune bought the LA Times, that was a big deal, and then things just...
Yeah.
Know. But where do you think the media went wrong when it comes to all the... So we have these very two interesting things going on. I'm sorry, this is totally not here to talk about, but I'm interested in your perspective on this because you work in the media, especially in publishing and print and reporting. While you don't write for a newspaper, you're kind of all in that realm, right? Huffington Post was a new age newspaper, or is. And so there are I feel like there's two different things going on. One is that media and technology has opened up the world for everybody to be reporters. So there's all these bloggers and there's all these different places for our eyeballs to go.
Yeah.
In the digital world. On the other hand, because I was working here and WGN Radio and the Tribune Company were all at one piece back when I was a producer here from 97 to 2007. And so when I first started out here, Chicago Tribune was online, but that was all still very new.
Yeah.
And all these newspapers invested very heavily in the internet and the web pages and they gave everything away. And I wonder if, to me, the big problem for newspapers is they started giving it away and can't figure out how to pull that back exactly and get people to buy in and get people to spend the money because, I mean, newspapers used to just print money.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And then you think about the Sunday paper that used to arrive at your door.
How thick it was.
That weighed 4 pounds. And now you get it and it's like the old Wednesday edition. It's terrible. It's sad. Every time I get the Sunday paper, I pick it up. I'm like, this is so sad. It depresses me.
It is. It is. I still get my Sunday Trib. And I mean, I'm always I think I'm not one of the, of all the good people in Chicago who are really smart on these ideas, mm-hmm. I don't think I follow them as closely or think of them. I mean, I'm a reporter, so I kind of stay in my lane with
sure.
that. But I mean, I have heard one of it's a very simple, some people kind of say very early on, things like Craigslist were the
killed because it killed classifieds.
Yeah,
and that was a huge moneymaker for newspapers.
I mean, I think the news industry bears a lot of the blame because it was, I mean, it's like the recording industry, you know, is incredibly slow
yeah.
to adapt. And, you know, they kind of blamed everybody but maybe the executives who are supposed to be the geniuses
yeah.
who make all these strategic business decisions and just didn't kind of didn't see in time. I remember when before I was even in school, before I was even in college, hearing stories about how there were editors, or not even editors, but business people who were kind of not so sure about this whole internet thing. And I remember something kind of funny in the Oscar award-winning movie Spotlight. They, you know, bombshell publication about, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, sex abuse scandal, and, you know, wins the Boston Globe a Pulitzer. And in the movie, which I think this happened in real life, they said, we have a www address we can print.
Yeah.
In the story where people could find it online. And I mean, obviously most people's reading habits at the time that story came out was in the late 90s, you know, was still print based.
Paper, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the news industry has not moved. They have not moved as quickly, I think.
Well, you bring up the recording industry and it's interesting because I really think Apple saved their asses.
Because, with Apple Music?
And... Yeah, because until we started... You know, nobody had really figured out there were some places to buy music. I can't remember what the first bigger sites were for MP3s. There were a few before Apple started the Apple Music Store. But with the iPod and Apple selling it, it really brought it back to a mainstream of this is how you do this. before they did that in such a massive way, there were places to buy MP3s, but it was also just as easy to download LimeWire. Remember having LimeWire?
Napster, yeah.
And Napster, right? Napster was huge, and people were stealing music like crazy. And while I'm sure that still is done to a great extent, I think Apple normalized the idea of 99 cents for a song, and you can still buy albums and this and that. However, Apple also helped destroy the whole idea of an album, right?
Yeah.
Because it made it so easy. Although we always had singles growing up, and you know, when I was a kid, there were 45s, and then it went to cassette singles. And I found in our garage recently, we were cleaning out the garage, boxes of cassette tapes. And we actually had some cassette singles. And I was thinking, God, why would you buy, looking back, a cassette single that you'd then, what, play, then rewind and play again?
It just seems like the craziest idea. I had so many cassette singles because they were cheaper than CDs.
Sure.
So if you were, at least if you were a kid on the limited budget,
yeah,
you had a Walkman. I mean, it does, in hindsight, it kind of is silly because, but you could get a you know, there was maybe a promo for a cassette single, and you could get that for maybe a dollar or two.
Was it
and
like a buck? Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a buck or two. And then the album, you know, would be maybe $12.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're a middle schooler, things like that, you're like, all right, I'll spend that dollar.
Isn't that funny, though, to think about? You had your Walkman, I'm going down to my friend's house and got my cassette single. And if it's more than a 3-minute walk, you're like, all right, well, I guess I'll play this again. Unless you had a pocket full of cassettes that you were switching out as you walked.
I actually went to the local record fair a couple weeks ago at the Empty Bottle, and there were some cassette-only labels, and I listened. They had a Walkman out there where you could listen to the tapes, and all of the cassettes came with digital downloads.
That's good.
And I still have a cassette player. I have a dual-deck cassette player, so if my friends want to come over and dub tapes. And I bought three of them because the music was really good, and I think it's fun. I mean, there's a little kitsch factor to putting your stuff
reminds
out
you
on.
Of you being younger. Although when you were young, were you listening to cassettes?
Yeah, I was listening to cassettes. Right. I mean, because you could tape off the radio.
I know. I remember the greatest Christmas ever. I got a Montgomery Ward stereo that had the two cassettes. So you could make your mixes, record right off the radio used to be a huge deal.
My brother, we have it somewhere on like the Bellware family archives on, you know, VHS video, where he got a dual deck, you know, boombox, which was the problematically named Ghetto Blaster. That was the actual.
It said it on there?
Yeah.
It says Ghetto Blaster on it?
It has that straight letter kind of hot rod looking light. Font that you would see like on a race car maybe.
Yeah.
And it was kind of small, and could segue into one of the stories that I think you wanted to talk about with
the inmates?
No, the music one.
I don't even know the music one. Tell me the music one.
I
didn't know.
It's
go
a couple,
ahead.
Well, because I know you want to talk to me about some of the recent work. This came out a couple weeks ago. I did a feature for BuzzFeed about the culture of music fans who are deaf.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And I talked to a lot of music fans in the Chicago area and in Chicago who are deaf. And there's one guy, Greg. He's the president of this really great local group called Deaf Planet Soul. And it's a nonprofit that does all sorts of arts events and advocacy for deaf and hard of hearing people. He grew up in the Bronx, and he said his first memory, and he's profoundly deaf, as his friend told me, he's deaf as you can get, you know.
Okay.
And when he grew up in the Bronx, he said, you know, everybody had the big boom boxes, and that's how he first got interested in music, because he could feel the vibration, and he could feel things on that. So he said it's kind of sad now that everybody listens on their phone, because there's not that.
There's no vibration.
Yeah, there's not that. You
he
know,
doesn't
kind of,
feel it on the street or in the city like he did.
And I mean, he has songs on his iPod, and
it's so fascinating.
It's a different experience. And I mean, I think one of the things too, it's interesting talking about this on radio.
Yeah.
But one of the other things that I learned in reporting this feature was a lot of hearing people like us, as I described in the story, we kind of think of deafness as, you know, one side or the other of a dividing line. You hear or you can't hear.
Yeah.
And it's a spectrum. So there are some people who are profoundly deaf and they don't have any ability to detect, their ears can't detect any sound. But some do have varying levels of hearing, and some also wear hearing aids or cochlear implants.
Sure.
And so they can hear some aspect. And for some people who wore hearing aids or cochlear implants, they could hear enough to communicate. If you were talking to them, they would be able to maybe read your lips, or if they were close, hear something. But at a concert, if they were in the back, they wouldn't be able to hear the vocals. They mm-hmm. might be able to get, you know, kind of the low ends of the bass and things like that, but okay. they wouldn't hear the words. And that's why being up front and having access in a designated deaf and hard of hearing area, which they had at Lollapalooza this year, is really important, because they can hear it better if they have any hearing ability. They can see the ASL, the American Sign Language interpreters, and they're closer to the music. And the kind of main woman I profiled, who's a huge music fan from the area, she just gets right up to those speakers. And right now, I can only hear out of one of these headphones. I'm really hoping it's the headphones.
It is the headphone, okay. I think. I'm sorry, give me a bad pair. No, it's in your head that you're like, yeah, I screwed up my ears.
I was up close for the whole weekend, and I had earplugs, but I was like, this is probably not good. They actually had some people, I mean, they can feel it. So it's funny, too, this guy, Greg from Deaf Planet Soul, he DJs. And, you know, he's a DJ and he's deaf. And
so interesting.
And he said that they're, you know, at dance parties where it's a mixed crowd or, you know, an all deaf and hard of hearing crowd, you still get complaints that the music's too loud.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Because then the vibrations are too strong, or because they can hear somewhat and it's overpowering?
I think a little of both. He said that when he rents his gear, he always takes the speakers without poles and then he puts it on the floor and tips it. Puts the speaker's face down on the floor instead of putting it on poles, so you can feel it through the floor more.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, it was really cool because there was stuff happening. You know, a lot of the big music festivals are really adding more of these services. The thing that was, I think, the most interesting to me, because we hear so much about this from the perspective of the interpreters, like, look at this cool YouTube video of an interpreter, you know, signing rap songs, and it was kind of how, you know, how much you have this entire population of potential music fans, of potential music performers,
yeah.
From the point, you know, the perspective of like a Live Nation customers, people who are planning for this trip as, you know, destination, you know, entire year in advance. And they just have to do a little bit to accommodate them. And they're really being left out of this. And a lot of it's because hearing-centric people kind of control the music business. And most of us probably don't think, we don't even think like, oh, someone who's deaf.
I would have never thought yeah. that they're going to concerts and things like
and
that.
And I had conversations with, you know, with fans there. And they told me the songs they liked. They're listening to the same stuff I like. I had so many of my kind of ignorances and biases challenged. I sort of thought, I was like, well, I bet that electronic music is the most, you know, popular, that rap is very popular because of all the bass and
yeah.
they like, you know, everything. Just, I mean, it's there is no difference except for the way they hear music. And the woman Lisa that I profiled, she even cuts her hair a certain way to help feel the music differently.
Really?
Yeah. And there's certain things that we probably take for granted because we're focusing on listening with our ears
yeah.
and they listen more with their body. And there's certain technology that companies are maybe developing, like, you know, wristbands, backpacks, things that can pulse with the music, being
yeah.
Bluetooth enabled. But really, I think having interpreters is...
See, that really throws me off.
What?
Because I can't see, and of course, I don't understand this at all because I don't have the hearing issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I just can't see being at a concert. If I can feel the vibrations and I'm getting into it that way, I can't imagine looking at somebody signing what the lyrics are. Is that what
yeah.
they're doing?
Yeah, they're signing the lyrics. And this was another thing that I kind of get into in the article, too, is sign language is fascinating. I think it's a really addicting language. I was watching the now defunct ABC Family drama Switched at Birth, which has it won a Peabody Award because it told several stories. They had main storylines were about characters who are deaf. And so they had entire scenes in sign language. And you're watching it and like you really get into it. And you I think you can pick it up a little, you know, kind of fast.
Sure.
But for ASL, some interpreters, they only do legal or they only do medical.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some that do music because it's kind of its own special thing. Just like not every person can sing,
sure.
not every person can interpret. And there is, you know, your whole body goes into it and there's a whole thing kind of, they are emoting, they're interpreting the singer's personality, the intent. So if it's, you know.
So they're emoting too. They're not just
yeah.
standing there real
no,
stiff.
Yeah. So if it's, if like, there's some fun videos that you could look at, you know, the really popular one. Well, like this is, you know, the Meghan Trainor song all about that bass. You know,
sure.
She's a little bit, kind of a little sexy, kind of a little
yeah.
confident. And there's kind of that, you know, like cocky kind of swagger that comes through in the interpreters, like in the gestures, in the face. They can do really cool wordplay, you know, with ASL. And there was a song that I was listening to where the sign for money kind of has the sign, making the sign where I'm like slapping my hand with mm-hmm. my other hand. And it reminds me of flapping a stack of bills in your hand.
Yeah.
And as someone who's watching, who I can hear the music, but I'm watching the interpreter, and it kind of makes the experience like have another dimension. And so I got a lot out of it seeing the interpreters, even though I don't even know sign language.
It's so funny because just earlier this week, I'm watching the Weather Channel two nights ago, and the governor from Florida is doing the evacuation. They've got the sign language person there. Mm-hmm. And there's always different sign language people, right? Some are very dry, some are, but this guy was like getting into it and making faces and like moving his hands a lot.
Yeah.
And I taped it a little and put it out on Twitter. Like, let's all live, your job's only as boring as you make it. Let's be this guy. And let's, you know, he's like totally getting into it and like acting it out instead of just giving the information. And I never would have, that's so fascinating because I just can't imagine watching, you know, you think of a, you know, like I try like crazy if I'm at a concert, if I'm close enough, not to look at the video boards.
Yeah.
Thinking, all right, I paid all this money to be here. Let's watch the actual performer perform instead mm-hmm. of just, you could have watched this on TV if you're doing that, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting because then it sounds like they're getting more out of just understanding what the lyrics are. It's part of the performance at a concert, the way the sign language is performed.
Yeah. Almost. I mean, the interpreter is really kind of trying to inhibit the persona. So the best ones, you know, work for a week, you know, on a set because they're trying to really get everything down. And interpreters are sort of seen as, they're considered invisible facilitator. So, for example, etiquette-wise, if there is an interpreter and I am deaf and you're not, and the interpreter is interpreting between the two of us, you should always look at me. It's weird and rude for you to look at the interpreter,
right.
You know, or say like, can you tell her that I'm saying this, you know? And it I think a lot of people too, maybe at concerts, if they see someone who's deaf, and there are people who told me this too, they said, if people find out that I'm deaf, they like kind of want to stop talking to me because they might be embarrassed or apologetic. And they said that makes everything weird. And you really can get along well with just a little bit of effort. Because I mean, you're talking to people who have one sense that's different than yours. Like they're not aliens, you know,
right.
and they're treated so differently sometimes. And it's really disheartening. I learned so much. I had a great time hanging out. So funny. And it was really cool being up front in the deaf and hard of hearing area with them. You saw how interpreters were there saving me. All of the people up front, like, they were fine getting along with each other. Like, I'm the one that needed them to be able to kind of be part of that world. And there was an emergency that happened, you know, as happens at Lollapalooza.
Sure.
We read the police reports, how many people get overserved or, you know.
Although I have to give Lollapalooza credit.
Yeah.
It's not nearly as bad as you would expect every year.
Not as bad as you would. But there was, so there's the front row, there's a barrier where there's this deaf and hard of hearing area, and then there's the stage. And that area up front is where people usually go if the medic needs to get to them. And so there was someone in the crowd, in like the general audience, who needed an emergency. They said what was up. The deaf crowd got it. The interpreters got it. And then they were able to pass the person up. The, you know, DHH crowd, as I'll call them, was able to get the person to the medic. Everything worked harmoniously. And it was a safer experience for everybody because they were interpreters that could, you know, the festival knew how to manage that. And they, some of the fans said, they said, that's scary. You know, you go to a festival and it got evacuated the first night. You're getting push alerts on your phone, but the incidental learning, the fact that someone two people over said, that parking lot's full, let's go out this exit. You don't have to be part of their conversation to learn that. But if you're deaf, you don't get any of that.
Yeah.
So, you can feel like you're kind of on your own. So that was a cool experience, and I was really glad that it was a national story, but it was based in Chicago. It was all Chicago players, which was special to me.
So that's at BuzzFeed.com. Can people still find that?
Yeah, people can still find that.
Kim Bellware is in studio with us. You can follow her on Twitter. Is it at Bellwack?
Yes.
At Bellwack.
I know
I don't
that
know
name
why.
Always it's the last name and the first letter of my first name.
Why would you do it so formal like an email address?
Well, because I was trying to save characters. It was back when Twitter had, when your username cut
had
into
limits.
To your 140 character limit. So I went for something really short.
All right. You can follow Kim at Bellwack. When we come back after the news, let's talk about inmates getting a divorce. This is a very interesting story. More to come, 720 WGN. 3 o'clock in the morning. You heard the tone a moment ago. Kim Bellware is with us. She did a story for The Atlantic recently about inmates. She writes a lot about justice issues in the and the death penalty specifically, but also about criminal justice. The headline, Why It's Difficult for Inmates to Get a Divorce. You would think it'd be very easy for an inmate to get a divorce because whoever's on the outside might be like, well, they might be, you know, standing behind them, but they might be like, all right, I got to move on. Let's get a divorce. But it's difficult for them. We'll find out why after we check the news. WGN, Matt Bubala with you here. I'm talking to Kim Bellware offline about the kids that I have because she didn't realize that I have triplets at home. I'm now trying to find a photo so I could show you all these
so
kids.
So many.
Oh, my God. There's a picture of us last time you were here.
Oh, that's right.
That's, well, it's the middle of the night, Kim. Neither we don't look so great in the middle of the night. We're, you know, we're dragging here. 312-981-7200 is the number. I'll get back. I'll show you a picture of all the kids later. Talking about fertility and how crazy that life can get for you real quick. But let's talk about the story that you did for The Atlantic about inmates and getting divorced. You've covered extensively death penalty issues, criminal justice issues. But here's an interesting twist on things, because I don't think anybody, although most people go, who cares if inmates get divorced? They're in there for a reason.
You read the comments.
Never read the comments. So tell me, how did you decide to get on this?
So I have kind of on and off over the past couple years focused a little more of my criminal justice reporting. I think you can find richer stuff when you focus in a little more. Sometimes it's by, you know, going really wide, but women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population.
You go, girls!
Yeah, they're small. It's about 10%, and it's growing. And it's,
which
it's,
we're not excited
yeah,
about.
We're not
it's
glad
terrible.
About. It's not a
this
good thing.
This is not what we're talking about with equal representation.
Yeah. But you know, it's a reality. And I had been hearing from attorneys, you know, and to a lesser extent, prisoners themselves, you know, really just men and women are different. And there are, I did a dispatch actually last December about that, that kind of went a little bit into some of the differences, but the prison system was largely men and it still is largely men and it's built around men. And so there's a lot of things that when it comes to, you know, women, and women aren't the only ones in prison who try and get divorces, but they have some unique barriers that kind of make addressing their needs different, because it is going to affect them differently getting a divorce in prison than it will men. And there's a local, the Cabrini Green Legal Aid, which is a local you know, legal aid group. They provide free representation to families for all sorts of issues during incarceration, after getting them back into the community. And they're the ones who tipped me off to this amazing program that is in Cook County. And when I asked other people nationally about it, you know, National Council of State Courts, you know, other people, how, you know, how widespread or how popular are these programs? People said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Nobody had heard of this, and everybody wanted to know. And they're like, I can't help you at all with your story, but when it publishes, please send it to me because I'd love to know more. So Cook County, in my research, was, which I, you know, I called probably, you know, a dozen different places, divorce lawyers, courts, you know, everything. Cook County, from what I turned over, is maybe one of the only places in the U.S. that has this really great program, which is kind of defying the stereotype of the justice system. You know, this program, it saves money, it's efficient, and everybody likes it.
And
that, that never happens.
And what's it for? It's to help inmates if they need to go through a divorce?
Yeah. So Judge Grace Stickler, who's a fantastic judge, she's the presiding judge of the Cook County Domestic Court, which is, I think, the single largest unified, it's in my article, I can't remember now. We're like the biggest unified, you know, family court in the country.
Okay.
And she, you know, access to the courts is a constitutional right. And it's something that we don't think about. You know, when you're in prison, a lot of your need to go to the court is probably mitigated by the fact that you're not out on the street, you know. But for civil issues, you know, there are parts of your life that still continue. Your family connections go on, you know,
yeah.
Your relationships go on. And if those need some attention from the court, you're in this crazy paradox where you can't get out. So in Cook County, if you want a, so if I want to, if I'm married and I want a divorce from my husband, this is all assuming that I do not have money to pay for a lawyer. And mm-hmm. the majority of people,
as most incarcerated people, in prison, people don't.
They don't.
Because that's how they end up
that's
there.
That's how they end up there. So if I want, if I can't afford a lawyer and I want to divorce my husband and he doesn't respond to the filing, he's not going to cooperate, he's not going to help me with this, so I file. In Cook County, if he doesn't respond, if I want to go forward and finalize the divorce, then I have to show up in person and request a court date from the clerk. But if I'm in prison, I can't do that. So, well, you can get a writ out of prison, mm-hmm. but you can only get a writ out of prison if you have a court date on the books. So there's no way for you to get
it's
out
catch
of this.
22.
Yeah, you're in this catch 22. And Judge Dickler found that they were just getting letters from people who needed these domestic issues and these civil issues settled, and they couldn't do it. So she just realized, look, people, you know, people in prison, they don't have their freedom. There are certain rights that they still retain, and access to courts is one of them. So how do we respond to this? And ultimately, it does save taxpayer money by making the system more efficient. So there was a lot of kind of fascinating things that cropped up in the research of that story.
So it's tough for somebody who is an inmate to get a divorce if the person... the other person wants a divorce. It's easy for them because they go find a lawyer and they go file everything.
Yeah.
That's simple. That's it. Boy, that's so fascinating. Who, and I don't mean to think about, oh, well, these people, what would they think? But it seems strange that you'd be locked up and say, and now's a good time to get a divorce.
Yeah, well, you know, so the story focuses on women because that's also primarily who the legal aid group serves. Mm-hmm. They do, there are men that they help, but primarily their focus is mothers in particular. And according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, 3/4 of women in prison are victims of domestic violence.
I thought that you were going to say that. I thought, boy, what, you know, why would they get a divorce? Because they were probably in a really bad marriage, and that's probably how they ended up in jail in some way.
Overwhelming number of women who are in jail, if they have any kind of violent issues, it's usually having something to do with the violence that they've experienced. So,
or I would imagine becomes a drug problem.
Yeah,
doesn't it? Because you try to
cope, yeah,
and survive.
And so you are, you're married to this person you don't want to be with, and you know maybe they're ruining your credit while you're in prison. The child issue was an interesting one. So. If a woman is married to and her partner is abusive to her and she goes to prison, then Department of Child and Family Services, DCFS, can take the kids away. And when mom gets out, if she wants to get her kids back, one of the best things she can do for her case of getting her children back is to file a divorce. For divorce, because it'll show DCFS that she's not going back to a bad situation.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of another kind of double way of punishing women, because now she's going to get punished if she doesn't, you know, even if the husband has never hurt the kids, you know, they can kind of leverage that against her. And
yeah.
And some women, they said, you know, just kind of the mental freedom of knowing that when it's hard enough reentering society. You know, can you imagine how much harder that is if you have someone who's trying to control you, maybe trying to hurt you? Like, you don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, you want that off your plate. And child visitation issues was another thing. I didn't get to check into this because it was kind of tangential, and I would love to do a story about it. But I had one lawyer tell me that certain probate issues, if you happen to be in prison, let's say you're an only child and your mother has a home and she dies, if you can't get someone to represent you and represent your interests to transfer that property, the state gets it.
Yeah.
So access this program, I guess to sum it up for listeners,
do they come into the jails? Do they bring the court to the jails then to make it easier and see everybody at once? Or?
In a sense, so the different state prisons, it's in the state prisons, because people who have matters in Cook County are, this is the other thing that a lot of prison reform advocates say, is why do we send people so far away from their communities and their families?
Yeah.
You know, they're 200 miles away and it's expensive. You know, no jail, no prison is going to have the money or the resources or the logistical capabilities to bring you up from Logan Correctional, you know, to Cook County.
Yeah.
So they have a video setup, pretty inexpensive and simple. The court has a setup and they can sort of digitally, you know, through video and audio, they can do this. And there is a committee with the Illinois Supreme Court that is looking at this system and seeing how they can replicate the formula for things like rural counties where people have to travel long distances and don't have public transit.
So even people who are free to do it, it's difficult because of where they live.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky because we live in this, I had jury duty this summer and I realized how lucky I was because I went to 26th and Cal, which is not far from where I live.
Yeah.
There were people that came from the far, they were on the Metro for an hour and a half to get to jury duty. It's like Cook County is very big and there are, other courts, around the county, but for some stuff you got to come downtown Chicago or you got to come to 26th and Cal. And if you live out in out in Palatine, that's a little bit of a hike, so we sometimes take that for granted, whether we need to be in court to fulfill our civic duty for sitting on a jury.
Yeah.
I got kicked off, by the way.
You did. Not kicked off.
They weren't going to pick.
You weren't selected.
They weren't going to pick a criminal justice reporter.
Were you very upfront about that?
Yeah. I mean, it felt like a reality TV competition.
Did you want to be on the jury?
No.
I did that.
I have done jury duty. I did it when I was in college. I actually think it's really fun, but I was on major deadlines.
So well,
I gotta get out of here.
Yeah.
But they saved. I was in like the last pan. I was in the last three people. I mean, the tail end of the day, and they were gonna pick one of us of the three, and we're all women. We all had different ethnic backgrounds and experiences with the criminal justice system. And I was like, I have no idea. There's no way they're going to pick me though. And they didn't. So
you were starting to sweat it out though.
Yeah, I was.
All right. Well, I'd be remiss if I let you go without talking a little bit about the death penalty, because you've written extensively about that over the years. And I always forget the name of the person that we first started talking about who went through terrible. This was it, Georgia,
Oklahoma, Richard Glossop in Oklahoma.
So he's the one that's almost been put to death like three times.
Yeah.
And then they keep getting the wrong drug and all sorts of stuff is going on. Where's the latest with his case?
He is Oklahoma. They had a pretty damning report come out, a grand jury report come out in two parts late last year and early this year that pretty much did a whole, I hate to use the word autopsy, but this whole look at their death penalty, their lethal injection system, and said, it's a mess. We're not doing this right. We've messed it up before. So it's on hold. And all and state level lawmakers in Oklahoma, there's always a pretty strong contingent that's, scrambling to find a new drug, a new way to push something forward. So right now, nothing is happening in Oklahoma as far as the death penalty. But I would not be surprised if within the next 12 months, a state lawmaker introduced an alternative drug, an alternative execution method. They've already floated the idea of a nitrogen gas chamber instead of cyanide gas chamber, because you can't run out of nitrogen, like lethal injection drugs. And for a lot of people who've been through, have witnessed these and seen the evolution of the death penalty process in the U.S., people are looking back to methods that we stopped using with good reason.
Hangings and firing squads and things like that.
And electric chair. I mean, a couple states, a handful of states still have some of those as a backup method.
Isn't it amazing to think, I mean, when we were kids, when I was a kid, they used the electric chair.
Yeah.
And if you think about that now, or have ever seen Faces of Death, those videos that were out in the 80s and stuff, to see somebody get electrocuted by an electric chair, it's amazing that that wasn't ruled or wouldn't be now ruled unconstitutional.
Yeah.
That it's not, what's the
cruel
phrase?
And unusual.
Cruel and unusual punishment.
I mean, I heard some horror stories from attorneys who had witnessed, a couple of them probably got to where they are now because they witnessed the big ones that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably informed their practice going forward and maybe led them to advocate against the death penalty. But I mean, not to get too terribly graphic on air, but I mean, you're talking about body parts catching on fire, eyeballs popping out of sockets, it's just a
gruesome, they would put a blindfold on them because of that, right?
And the thing that I still find so remarkable when I learn more is there really isn't a great, because it's all the states, you know, the states, they kind of can do, they devise their own way, and you can't really practice killing someone and say, did we do this? Like, did we do a good job? Yeah. Like, did we do this fairly? Did everything go well? Like, you can't do any do-overs. And I think it was Frank Thompson, who was a former warden. I think he was overseeing Oregon's death chamber at the time. Now he's an anti-death penalty advocate. But it was him, or maybe it was someone else, but they were talking about how when they would attach the anode? Or the diode? Oh, I don't remember. They would attach the thing to your
electrode?
Leg. The electrode, yes. Okay. It was the right ode. They'd attach the electrode to your leg. And they have them in a few places on the body, including the head. And they attach it to the leg, so they roll up your pant. They would roll up the prisoner's pant leg. And during the electrocution process, it's just a, you know, toggle of how much energy you're putting through, and it depends, like, how big is the person,
sure,
what's their composition of muscle to fat, you know, all these things. So if you overjuice someone, you can burn, you burn their body. And this guy was shaking violently, so the pant leg drooped and drooped until it hit the electrode, caught on fire, pant leg caught on fire. So when they did it the next time, they just cut the pant leg off at the knee. Like, it
very efficient.
The death penalty is trial and error in every way, which makes it even more baffling.
Well, and it's amazing. If we're going to have a death penalty, why in the world? I mean, we have surgery all the time.
Yeah.
Get completely knocked out, don't feel a thing. Right?
Yeah.
So you know it's possible that if they wanted to, mm-hmm, you just put somebody completely under. So they just went to sleep, and then you do whatever. You do a gas chamber, you could do the other drugs, the other cocktails, whatever. The fact that there's stories of, like, the death penalty of, you know, electric chairs, or even all these other drugs we're having where, well, it only paralyzes them, so they're still awake, and then they're being killed. It's like we have this cruel, like, no, it can't be that simple.
Yeah.
There has to be some, you know, it's
they
like
have to suffer
somehow. It's not enough that they're dying. Yeah, we know they're dying, but they need to know that they're dying.
Yeah.
You know, because it really could be a humane sort of, you know, when we put pets down, they basically go to sleep.
I've definitely heard that that in the United States, we take more care euthanizing animals.
Oh my God,
than we do
by far. I'm sure.
You know, executing people, which is a kind of a mind-boggling one. But,
well, it's because the dogs generally didn't.
Yeah.
There aren't a bunch of people pissed off at the dog.
People have a very different attitude on that. I'm sure it's going to come up again and again. But it was a conversation that came up. With some DePaul College kids, some freshmen who are starting in the journalism program. Great, great group of students. And they were asking about, you know, kind of like, how do you, you know, what are you surprised to hear? And I told them one of my favorite kind of early to the death penalty stories is you go in thinking one thing before, mm-hmm, I knew anything about it. You go in thinking, like, anybody who's, you know, whose daughter gets killed by Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing, which this was the first death penalty victim's family member I ever spoke to. I was like, this guy, I bet he is so for it. I bet he is, like, he hates Timothy McVeigh, like, all of this stuff. I knew nothing. This guy, I mean, he really made a huge impression about why he was against the death penalty. And it wasn't religious reasons. I think that's always been a thing, you know,
yeah,
kind of the whole, you know, ideal of mercy, you know, and for religious reasons, people will be against the death penalty. But in Nebraska, where Pete Ricketts, brother of Cubs owners, you know,
yeah,
Laura and Todd and Tom and all them,
sure,
who's the governor, he sponsored a referendum to bring the death penalty back. And when the voters were duking it out, I talked to two women who both had, one had lost her brother in this torturous, awful way. Another woman had lost her daughter, who was killed as a victim of a bank robbery. And both of these women had completely opposite attitudes towards the death penalty. One absolutely wanted it. One wanted nothing to do with it. And she actually forgave her her brother's killer. And the man ended up dying in prison. But I think something that is always important to remember is, at least where the victims are concerned, you know, you don't want to forget about the victims,
yeah,
and what they want. Is there's no right way to be a victim. You know, I'm not going to sit here and tell someone whose loved one has been taken from them, like, you shouldn't feel that way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to feel how they're going to feel.
Yeah.
I think what is problem is when politicians kind of exploit those feelings, and that's what the Oklahoma City bombing father felt. It was Merrick, I think I brought this up on the show before, it was Merrick Garland, the unsuccessful Supreme Court nominee, who was the prosecutor of that case, and he was pro-death penalty, and the father was saying he felt really angry because he felt that the prosecutors were trying to push the family towards advocating for the death penalty and saying, this is going to, you'll have justice now. And he was saying, what are you talking about? Yeah. If this guy lives, this guy dies, my daughter's still gone. I still feel terrible. So don't tell me that putting this guy to death will help me, because I won't. And you, and now you're making these big families, or these big promises to families that you can't fulfill. Some families might feel better for it, but can you imagine how terrible that would be for a family to say, just let us do this, let us execute this guy in your name, in your daughter's name, in the name of the state, and all will be well. And then that happens, and you still feel the same way after. Like, that's, and there's no take backs on
that's
that.
That's certainly a promise you shouldn't make as a prosecutor. I can understand why they're going for the death penalty in some, especially something like that. And I guess the one thing, what I would, if I was prosecuting a death penalty, I wouldn't promise them you're going to feel better, but I would say, I don't know. I guess the selling point would be that he won't be around to exploit your family anymore, or to, you know, somebody like that who you worry is going to develop a cult following or is going to espouse these scary ideas that we should
like
take,
a Charles Manson type,
something like that. You know, he blew up a whole building with children and everything in it, and you don't want him to inspire anybody else to do that. And the most assured way maybe to prevent him from inspiring other people is to not allow him to be able to write, to be publicly in contact with anybody. And so there's your closure that I would try to give versus you're going to feel better. Well, nobody's ever going to feel better because we're not bringing that person back.
And
right?
Sometimes executing them, though, it's kind of the martyr thing. You know, it elevates their profile because that's a, you know, think of all the people who are in Supermax. Like, there's a lot of people there that, at the time, their crimes were huge, and they didn't get executed, and they just are locked away in maximum security
and
for the rest of their life. And you just kind of forget about them.
With a lot of them, I would be sure McVeigh's going to come up again and again because that's such a famous and such a terrible tragedy, and was such a mass scale, right? The Ted Kaczynski thing that's going on right now, I didn't know he was still alive. I thought he got the death penalty until... Have you watched the show that's on this summer at all?
What?
There's a show called Manhunt Unabomber on Discovery Channel. It's just an 8-episode series, but it goes over how they caught the Unabomber.
Oh, I'm going to have to go home and watch this immediately.
And it's so good. I can't believe how good it is. We got to take a break. Thank you so much for coming in,
Thank
Kim.
You
it's
for having
always
me.
A pleasure to have you here. Follow Kim on Twitter at Bellwack, B-E-L-L-W-A-K. It's not as crazy as it sounds. It's just sort of her last name and her first name.
Right.
Ish. Matt Bufala with you. News next, 720 WGN.